Good evening. James McKenney here with my Science Hour, November 17th, 2011. Tonight's main science topic, I will be talking about the microwave background radiation. What does it mean? What's the standard explanation? And what is it really, what is the real explanation for that? It's being used to support the Big Bang concept, but something the scientists have failed to do, and I'll talk about that. And they've failed to do the proper research. They haven't done their homework, and they're jumping to conclusions. Very, very much, unfortunately, a Nobel Prize was given to researchers with 30-year-old data from the Colby mission. From the Colby mission, it was called, a satellite. And unfortunately, I believe it was more of a political award than anything else. The Nobel Prizes are supposed to be given to individuals for individual effort. And this was given to, and one of the very specific things in the Nobel rules is it should not be given for research done by especially government-supported research, and the research that they awarded the Nobel Prize for a few years ago for the work on the Big Bang and the background radiation, the microwave background radiation, it was a real political gift, I would say, but that very much government-funded, government-politicized science, so to speak, and just a very bad bad taste in the mouth for anything Nobel Prize. I believe it was the same year they gave Obama the Nobel Prize for Peace. So I'm not sure what the guys in the Nobel Committee were smoking that year, but pretty ridiculous. Anyway, be that as it may, I'll be talking about the microwave background radiation. What does it mean, but what is it really? What is going on out there that we're seeing microwaves, the same frequency of electromagnetic radiation that you have in your microwave in your house, is coming at us from all directions in outer space? I'll be talking about the failures of science to do proper measurements. And one thing that it will change over time in relatively short periods of time. So the scientists could take readings today and they would be very different from what they saw 30 years ago, which would tell you immediately that that is not from something far away and something that happened billions of years ago and should be very stable. But at any rate, okay, but first of all, I want to talk about Jupiter winds. These continue. And I know probably everybody listening has experienced these over the past month or month and a half. There are winds that come to your area, straight line winds, and they blow and they blow and they blow. They can blow your house down. They can rattle your windows, and these winds will blow for days and weeks at a time, night and day, without stopping. And then that storm system moves through, and you then have the Jupiter winds. Let me explain what happens. It'd probably be a little bit easier to understand this phenomenon. And I started talking about this, and I coined the term Jupiter winds on my October 20th show. So if you're not quite sure of the details here, go back and listen to that show. Of course, all of my shows are archived on the radio or on my webpage, jmccsci.com. They're there for free. But the October 20th show is when I started talking about the Jupiter winds. What are Jupiter winds? Earth and Jupiter have been in an electrical alignment here for about a month, and it'll continue over about the next month. The end of October was the actual visible or observable alignment of Jupiter with Earth. but that many times doesn't have a lot to do with the electrical alignment, which are connected along electric and magnetic field lines that are associated with the solar wind, etc. So, but here's what happens. That electrical connection between Jupiter, of course, is discharging the solar capacitor, and Earth is discharging the solar capacitor. So we have these long electrical discharges that extend in the sunward direction from planet Earth and then out away from Earth. These are mislabeled by standard astronomy. They call them a magnetic tail. Well, certainly there's magnetism there, but magnetism doesn't occur unless there are electrical currents. Well, where do the electrical currents come from? So the standard explanations, they stop at magnetism and try and pretend like magnetic fields and magnetic phenomena simply happen, and they're like the root, the base cause of these phenomena. Magnetic fields simply do not self-generate and exist out of thin air. They need electric currents to generate the magnetic fields. And so this is all well understood. So why do standard astronomers have concepts, magnetic reconnection, as if these magnetic fields are jumping around and jumping up and down and doing things all on their own? So anyway, the real story is that the electrical connection between Earth and Jupiter, the discharge of the solar capacitor, these long current sheets that pass by the planets in the sunward direction and in the anti-sunward direction, they start to connect, which makes a discharge from inside Earth's orbit far to the sunward side of Earth, all the way out to Jupiter, and then very far beyond Jupiter. So we're discharging an extremely large area of the solar system, where typically we would be discharging maybe a little bit of the distance to Mars, the next planet out. But now we're connecting electrically with the far reaches of the solar system. And so what happens? Well, these electrical currents whipping around like a big snake, it's the rapid change of these electrical currents that cause a series of events. They can compress Earth's magnetic field, and then these effects work their way down to the troposphere where our weather systems form. What happens is the electrical currents can tap down into the lower atmosphere and start driving weather systems. These are the whirling weather systems that surround low-pressure cells. Last week I talked about jet streams and how the jet streams wrap around the low-pressure cells and the high-pressure cells. So typically the storms we're talking about are low-pressure cells. Low-pressure cells are typically storm and stormy activity. High-pressure cells are typically, the low-pressure cells are rotating in a counterclockwise direction as you're looking away from Earth, and you're looking from a distance at Earth. The low-pressure cells are spinning in a counterclockwise direction. The high-pressure cells are spinning in a clockwise direction. And the jet streams wrap around these pressure cells, low and high, as the jet stream, in the case of the northern jet stream, moving from west to east, called a westerly direction. In other words, the winds are from the west. But the point is that once these normally existing low pressure cells start connecting with those electrical currents that are coming in from this overall electrical connection with Jupiter, once they start driving these lower weather systems, then that's where it pumps up the energy, driving up the wind speeds, and these wind speeds are approaching 100 plus miles an hour. Colorado, San Francisco, this past week were the victims. Once these connections are made, they maintain for maybe a week, 2 weeks, and then that weather system moves in an easterly direction, just like any other weather system. The only difference is now you have a tremendous amount of power coming in from outside that normally would not be there. And this is associated with the electrical alignment with the planet Jupiter. We're in an inferior conjunction with Jupiter, and that means that we're between Jupiter and the Sun. So this continues. This started probably over a month ago, and this is going to continue for into the probably another month. So at any time, you could be hit with these powerful winds. And these are in places that typically don't have this kind of wind activity. There are places, and there are certain seasons, where certain areas typically will get high winds. The Caribbean area might be in April. The the Great Lake areas may have what they call northwesters. In other words, the jet stream comes in from the northwest and drives some pretty horrendous wind systems into the Great Lakes area in north-central United States. That happens in November. And so they're very famous. The famous wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald happened in November when October. But it was due to those seasonal winds. Well, those are seasonal winds. The Jupiter winds are not seasonal. They tend to be associated with the inferior conjunction. Earth is inferior to Jupiter. Jupiter is superior, in other words, a superior conjunction with the planet Jupiter. So at any rate, the folks out in Colorado, if you're wondering what happened this week and why you're getting these winds, that's why. And I have to get a real kick out of the National Weather Service that the official explanation was doggone, it's windy. They have no clue why these winds are there. And they're not predicted. In their standard weather models, there's no reason for there to be strong winds in Colorado or San Francisco this week. Why there? What's the deal? Where does this come from? It's not predicted in the standard weather systems. It's just like a few weeks ago, the weather systems that moved across the northeastern states of the United States moved in very quickly, once again driven by this Jupiter connection. It's very plain to see, very simple to see, and I know that the mill boys are out there measuring these. They're very busy, while the Tier 2 scientists have no clue what's going on. That's what they pawn off on the public. So at any rate, it really deserves mention because in, say, for example, a Planet X scenario. Now, remember that if a Planet X object comes into the solar system, the overall effect would discharge the solar capacitor, and what you would see is a giant comet, not a big orange ball up in the sky or whatever. You would see a large comet. That comet would interact with the sun, causing CMEs and coronal mass ejections from the sun and potential severe weather on Earth. The comets passing by could be directly connecting electrically to Earth, and that's what the ancients saw. Remember, Moses talks about the whirlwind of fire extending up into the sky, and so it was very much like a giant tornado. These people saw these things. Phenomenon where a large comet was passing by at that time, and now we know that was the comet that eventually became the planet Venus. Of course, standard science is oblivious to all of this. They can't explain what happened in history, or the Noah event, or the Moses event. That's, by the way, why I just released about a little over a month ago, the new CD, a couple months ago now, the new 2-CD set, where I talk about the physics of Planet X and ancient celestial disasters. What happened back then? Why can't standard science explain these so they, most churches today and religions teach this as kind of like it's fairy tale. It's really not real. It's just kind of like, yeah, we got to teach this. We have no clue what happened here. And so, I guess, you know, they really don't teach it as if it were real. You know, Noah built an ark. This was a big ship. And stocked it full of animals with all the food they would need. Somebody had tipped him off. Somebody knew that something was going to happen. So there was a worldwide flood that killed off all of the people on planet Earth, just about. There were some survivors, but there weren't very many. And that's what the Old Testament is, by the way, it's a genealogical record of the genealogy of the descendants of Noah, all the way down to Moses, and etc., all the way down to Christ, to see where those people came from. And by the way, that's why it's so absurdly ridiculous. There are some groups of people out there trying to lay claim to everything under the sun of the Israelites. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. This history is well documented and well written, and that lineage going all the way down through thousands of years is well known. It's well described. So for somebody to try and jump in the 21st century and say, oh, by the way, that's us. No, sorry, ain't going to fly. Not in my book, anyway. So at any rate, another thing I wanted to mention about the Jupiter situation is that the ancients used to have a name for these winds that happened when comets passed by. They called them the devil winds. They're just tremendous winds where you cannot stand up. This past summer, I happened to be up in the Canadian Rockies when one of these wind events was occurring. And it was so windy that people couldn't stand up. I mean, people were being blown around like feathers. I'm not kidding you. It's just unbelievable to see what a 70 or 80 mile an hour wind will. You cannot walk in it. You can't stand up. You'll be lucky to get to the ground and crawl around. There's a legend of a North American Native American who survived. I believe this goes down to one of the Hopi legends, that one of the ancestors, that this goes back thousands of years, to when the large comets were coming through the solar system, the devil winds that they talked about were so powerful, one survivor, the word was passed down through the generations, one survivor lived in a ditch for a period of time until this passed, and that's how this person survived to come back and reconstruct the human population. So, but they had a name for this. They called them the devil winds. The devil winds. Winds that are just horrendous. A lot of these people lived in shallow caves. They either found or dug small, shallow caves, and that's where they waited this process out until the winds subsided, until the storm subsided, and they could come out and start rebuilding their lives again. Okay, switching gears a little bit. This past week, the sun kicked out a number of major solar flares, CMEs, and the issue here, now a number of weeks ago, twice in October, we had comets come in and interact with the sun electrically like a spark plug, as I say, discharging the solar capacitor in the vicinity of the sun and cause some significant coronal mass ejections. A coronal mass ejection, or CME, is where basically it looks like the whole surface of the sun lifts off in an explosion. These come out sometimes directed towards just out away from the sun. Space is a very big place, so when these come off of the sun, very rarely do they actually come directly at Earth. There's one that hit Venus, the planet Venus, almost directly this past week. It also passed the planet Mercury. So that can happen where these come directly at one of the planets, including Earth, but these were not necessarily Earth-directed. I want to also make it clear that although sometimes, in fact, on relatively rare occasions, comets can cause the explosions on the sun, these are relatively rare events, and the sun is doing this on a regular basis, especially as we move into the further into the solar cycle, the sun increasing in energetic output. And by the way, the sun and its ability to kick out selectively kick out large volumes of matter is in direct opposition for a number of reasons with the standard core fusion model of the sun, where and there was good reason when they built the core fusion model, suggesting that the fusion, the heat engine of the sun was in the core. That was some, at the time, good physics. They believed that the surface of the sun was a very smooth orange ball at around 6,000 degrees. And due to the fusion fire going on, they knew that something was going on. It was nuclear. Hans Bethe won the Nobel Prize for the chemistry, the nuclear chemistry of how the building blocks build up, how the chain of heavier atoms comes about through the nuclear reactions that are going on in the sun, starting out with hydrogen and helium, and deuterium, etc., building up in the sun. All good physics. The only problem is, when they finally got out to the sun to take a real look at the sun, the surface of the sun is a boiling cauldron. It has flares coming out. It's very electrical. It has a corona of electrons, relativistic electrons in orbit around the sun. There's no gravitational force that could keep these electrons there. It's basically a super atom. It's an electrical atom state. How does this happen? Standard physics has no answer for these questions, and it never is going to have an answer. How does the energy get from the sun that's only 6,000 degrees into relativistic electrons which are orbiting the sun? I mean, it's just, there's no mechanism for this. So how does this happen? Well, the only answer is that the sun is electrical and that the electrons are orbiting a positively charged surface of the sun, and then it's just basically a super atom that is, and then we view the sun from our vantage point with a net negative charge, because coming out of this electron shell is the solar wind. That's where the coronal holes attach. It's like a big screen. If you want to accelerate charged particles in a physics laboratory, you take a screen, literally like a window screen of metal, you set it up at a voltage, at a potential, electrical potential, and you then allow free electrons or free ions, positively or negatively charged, whatever the case, into the vicinity of that screen, and they will accelerate up to that voltage, giving them a kinetic energy or an energy of movement. And then they pass through that, and they can move out into beyond the screen. This is how the old tubes worked, the electron tubes that powered radios and radio transmission, radar, etc. But the point is that the electrons surrounding the sun act in the same manner, and that's what drives the solar wind, the bulk positive charged solar wind out into the space. And that's what the CMEs are all about. But none of this could possibly be true if the source of fusion for the sun was deep in the core. I was at a scientific meeting one time, and there was a good 15,000, 17,000 scientists from all over the world at this scientific meeting. And a guy came in who had been an engineer. He was a very well-renowned engineer. And he had he asked me a question. And I was at my booth. It's a booth that you set up at the basically a convention of scientists. And I was there. He asked me, he said, look at this physics problem. He said, okay, given the solar wind, the amount of solar wind, this is the matter coming out of the sun in terms of electrons and protons. He said, look at the solar wind level, and this was supposedly much more powerful back in the early history of the sun, according to standard models. But he said, just assume that it was the same for all that time. And he claimed, and the standard science claims it was about 4.5 billion years worth of time. So he said, calculate the mass loss of the sun due to the solar wind. And so that wouldn't take an average physicist long to do that. It turns out that it's more mass than the entire sun. So the sun could not continue this process of throwing out solar wind for 4.5 billion years because there's not enough matter there. He also pointed out the following. The sun gives off a known amount of light. And there again, standard science says that earlier in history of the sun produced a lot more energy, thusly giving off a lot more visible light, X-rays, ultraviolet light, infrared, microwave, whatever. That the sun was supposed to have given off much more energy in the past, but then this scientist asked me, he said, just imagine that it's the same level now going back through history, and go back through 4.5 billion years worth of history, given the amount of light that we're seeing coming from the sun now. And as I said, it would have been much more in previous times as you went back farther and farther, according to standard science. He said, now that light, we know, comes from conversion of energy, from mass to energy. The Einstein's equals mc squared tells you the amount of matter that is burned to give you the amount of light energy coming off the sun. He said, now make a calculation. If the given rate of the solar radiation output right now, calculate that for 4.5 billion years and calculate the mass loss. So, okay, so then what it turns out is that the sun doesn't have enough mass to support that. So combine the two, the solar wind output and then the light output of the sun, and you've got a big, 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 big problem in theoretical physics. None of the standard theoretical physicists that work in this area will acknowledge this problem. And it's major. I mean, you can't walk out the front door without answering this guy's question, because it's very clear. The sun does not have enough mass to provide the solar wind or to provide the light energy that it is putting out today. It is nowhere near enough to cover 4.5 billion years of time. So the standard model of where did the sun come from? How does fusion work on the sun? Where did the planets come from? If the sun is has less age than the planets, then we got a big problem, because we didn't have all the planets here orbiting an empty spot, and all of a sudden the sun came in. Standard physics, astrophysics, space science, astronomy has some major, major theoretical problems. They're very simple, and they do have answers. The answer is that know, the sun probably is not 4.5 billion years old, and probably the planets are not either. But the sun has to have a very different fusion process. Also, to account for the varying the variability of the surface of the sun, not the core, but the surface, you have to look at some kind of dynamic process where material is coming into the sun at a constant rate, or at a variable rate, actually. And then this turns around and burns. And the fusion has to be up at the surface of the sun. So what you're seeing is that the standard models, the core fusion model of the sun, could not possibly be true. It looked pretty good when Hans Bethe first promoted this. And, you know, that was based also on real nuclear physics. You can create nuclear bombs using those concepts. But is that what's going on in the sun? Could there be more than one nuclear process? Well, actually, there is. And so that's the entire situation with the surface of the sun. So when we see CMEs coming off the surface of the sun is interacting. It's very active. It's a cosmic nuclear fire, if you will. It's a nuclear fire going on the surface of the sun that is instrumental in throwing out the excess current of positive charge, and that is what causes the Earth and the other planets and the comets and every grain of dust that's floating around the sun, every asteroid, every comet, that's causing all of them to discharge this solar capacitor. And so that's where we enter the electrical nature of the solar system. Galaxies do this too. Galaxies have a fusion core at the center. They're throwing out a proton wind, and that proton wind has to cycle back, so it comes flowing down the galactic arms. Those are the rivers of charge, the rivers of electricity. When I talked to the original work I did around 1982 with spacecraft design, shows how you can ride those electrical currents between the stars. So all of this is linked together, but you will never get to the true understanding or true ease of living in the universe and travel in the universe. You won't ever get there listening to standard science. They're still trying to blast off from Earth in rockets, something that should have gone out. That's real cave-age technology in terms of outer space. When you look at electromagnetic propulsion systems, by the way, these are all described in my books, and these are experimentally verified. So this is not just ideas or Flash Gordon ideas. These are real ideas that have laboratory proofs that are on record. So at any rate, just a quick note here. I wanted to talk about the Japanese contamination of Japan with nuclear fallout from the Fukushima nuclear reactor. Now, Japan, here's a study that just came out. This was actually on CNN, I think on Monday or Tuesday's news this past week. It said that a new study, an independent study, did computer modeling of the prospects of possible contamination on the northern, especially the northern area of Japan. And what this study is saying is that there should be a lot of radiation there based on wind patterns, based on other scientific conditions, physical conditions in that area. But what is clear from the article is that these people did not do a physical study. They did a computer modeling study based on wind patterns and the amount of cesium, for example, radioactivity that was let out of the Japanese Earth nuclear reactors after the earthquakes that occurred there this past year. But the point that I want to make here is that the articles make it very clear that the Japanese government has not done any studies relative to the amount of nuclear contamination in the food-producing northern areas of Japan. The government in Japan has not done any studies there, so the people have no idea how contaminated their food is. I would say very likely within a number of years, if not sooner, the cancer and death rate in Japan due to side effects from the contamination, the death rate in Japan is going to be just horrendous. So at any rate, just another tale of human disaster and inability of governments to cope with disasters. And so what do? They cover it up. Okay, on to the main science topic, the microwave background radiation. We all are familiar with microwaves. It's a form of radiation, and you can use it to cook food. The reason you can use cook food is because water absorbs microwaves. So you put anything, if you put dry food in a microwave, it would not heat up. Well, eventually would, but basically the reason food heats up in your microwave is because water in the food absorbs the microwaves, and that heats up and causes your food to become hot. So at any rate, the point is that in outer space, there was both a prediction a long time ago, and this is from people who believe in the Big Bang, that if there was a bang and everything blew up, that there would be a residue radiation in the form of microwaves. These are very cool in terms of the radiation that comes off of a hot body. In physics, one of the phenomena that you look at that's called black body radiation, if you took an iron, say, like you iron clothes, and you put it on a table, and you could heat it up so it's red hot or glowing hot or orange if you heated it up enough. But typically, we don't see that heat in like a fish would, because its eyes are sensitive to infrared heat. Well, far below that on the energy scale of electromagnetic radiation is the microwave range. And so at any rate, there was a prediction that after the Big Bang, one would be able to detect an even consistent glow of microwaves coming from all directions in outer space. So scientists put together a package, a scientific satellite package, that would measure the microwave background radiation. But things like this need time. They need scrutiny, and they need other people from other areas of endeavor to come in and take a look at this. Two things that the scientists did not do. They took their initial readings, and they said, okay, now we have a map of the microwave background radiation. And with the sensitivity of the COBE experiment, they at first thought that the microwave background radiation was even or consistent or uniform. After a time, there was another satellite that was sent into outer space, and it measured a very inconsistent, kind of a globular construction of the microwave background radiation. What they didn't do, or if they did, they failed to report it. They did not report the change in the microwave background radiation. So if it changed on a short-term scale, they would have a problem, because if it's coming from a long-term source, and it's the same issue with the fusion core model of the sun. The fusion core model of the sun gives a very consistent picture of what the surface of the sun should look like. Since the core of the sun is emitting energy, it turns into X-rays, and those X-rays basically have to be emitted, reabsorbed, re-emitted, reabsorbed zillions of times before they reach the surface. With that model, the surface of the sun should be nothing more than a pure glowing orange ball of light. That's not what we see. There's the core model of fusion core model of the sun does not predict or explain solar flaring or magnetic fields or electrical phenomena or solar wind. It doesn't explain any of those because that energy should be simply coming off in the form of a black body radiation, all the way up through X-rays and all the way down through microwaves. The spectrum of the sun does not match the theoretical predictions. The same situation is true with the microwave background radiation. What the second satellite saw was a very blotchy structure in the microwave background radiation. In other words, if you look out in one direction, it was more intense than in another direction. And so it was very blotchy. Well, this was not what the original prediction stated, but as with anything in standard science, it's all well and good. They can change anything to match the between theory and data, because keeping the theory, it turns out, is much more important than interpreting the data objectively. So, at any rate, what's the real cause of the microwave background radiation? Well, if you took a reading over a long period of time, say 20 years, then that blotchy reading of the microwave background radiation should change. That's what I say. And it should change on a fairly, well, not very rapid rate, but a fairly regular basis. And it would change with time. How would it change? Well, it's hard to predict because it's based on actually factors that are very near our solar system. What my model of solar activity predicts is that the solar wind pushes out and it holds back a cloud of dust and gas far beyond the orbit of Pluto. When I first started this, and you'll see this in my original papers, they're published in the appendices of the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. When you see those those papers, they talk about this cloud, this nebular donut cloud, I called it at the time, being somewhat past the orbit of Jupiter. But now there are spacecraft, the Voyager spacecraft, the Pioneer spacecraft, have gotten out way beyond in the region of the orbit of Pluto, so this is way beyond Jupiter, and they're starting to encounter what appears to be the edge of the solar system, of where the particle velocities and directions change. In other words, they're no longer controlled by the sun. So at any rate, you can see other stars. Here's somewhat the key. You can look at other stars. Literally, almost every star in the vicinity of the galaxy near us, you take a look at these stars, and they have a big donut-shaped cloud of dust and gas around them. And this dust and gas is illuminated by the light coming from the star. So what does that tell you? That if you were in that inner region and you looked out and you looked at with a microwave detector, you would see microwave background coming from that surrounding dust and gas cloud. That's what astronomers are seeing. They're not seeing something that came from the other side of the universe that happened 4.5 billion years ago. They are seeing with the COBE and with the other satellites that look for microwave background radiation, they are in fact detecting a microwave radiation. How do you tell the difference between my idea and their idea? Well, it's somewhat simple, but not easy, as most things in science. They're not exactly easy. What happens is, number one, they first have to measure the background radiation over time. it should be changing. One should be able to detect change in the intensity based on the direction in outer space. You should be able to detect a change in the intensity of the microwave background radiation. And number two, to really be sure, you would have to get a spacecraft out beyond that nebular cloud that surrounds our star and look out, and I bet you $1 million that what you're going to see is nothing. You're going to point that spacecraft back towards our sun, and you would be able to detect that cloud of dust and gas, the microwave background radiation surrounding our star. In fact, there would be an easy experiment to do. Just take a look at the dust clouds that surround other stars, but you would need the sensitivity of a powerful telescope, and that's hard to do with microwaves. So, at any rate, doing the proper experiments is not something that's going to happen soon. To be able to send a spacecraft out beyond where, to date, the farthest spacecraft is still inching its way along out there, trying to move out beyond this nebular ion cloud that surrounds our star. But you would have to send a microwave detector and a satellite package out beyond that point and then look out into deep space from that vantage point and look at the microwave background radiation. And my prediction is that when you look in all directions, you're going to see pretty much nothing. The microwave background radiation that is being measured is in the vicinity of our solar system. And it's due to the nebular ion cloud that surrounds our solar system. You can see these, but possibly with an improvement in accuracy and pointing with some microwave equipment, it might be possible someday to look at other stars and see the microwave background radiation, so to speak, from directly around those stars, and conclude that that's what we're looking at. But now there's some political problems. How do you undo the Big Bang? How do you undo a Nobel Prize? How do you undo textbooks and decades of dominance of the Big Bang theory? So the end result is that the science that is being handed to the public today is very political. Okay, so in summary, why am I talking about this? This is rather far-fetched information for some of the people that listen to this show. But what I'm trying to do in a lot of these shows, I'm talking about details, and the standard science community is a set of dominoes. It's like any set of structure of organized information. And so what happens when you take one of those dominoes or a couple of those dominoes out of the mix, out of the line? Well, you know what it's like in those scenes in the movies where they push one domino and all of the dominoes fall in a row. Well, what happens if you take out one or two rows of dominoes? Then when one domino falls, it doesn't hit another one, so the process ends. And so another way of looking at it is that the theories, standard theories, once one of them falls, they all tend to fall. So they have to circle the wagons. They have to keep the theoretical structure there. None of them can break rank. They don't want to upset the apple cart. Because if one falls, they know that all of them will fall. And what's a PhD scientist that has studied the Big Bang all his life? Where's that guy going to get a job? I mean, but there's a lot more to it. As I've always said, the ability of the world controllers to control science. This has always happened throughout history. Leaders have always known they have to feed incorrect information to the public to control them. It's a very simple issue. It's a control issue. And so if all of the standard science you put together, if none of it is correct, well, that's a perfect structure to pawn off on the public, because the real information is going to set those people free. And nobody in government wants that. Their livelihood depends on you being stupid and enslaved. And at the very center core of this is science. If the people out there in mass really learn the true scientific workings of the cosmos, they would realize that, for example, chemical rockets are useless. That's a joke. That's not the way to go into space. You're going to be limited. They're going to be talking about going to the moon in 20 years. And that's something they supposedly did in the 1960s. But they're going to, every president that comes along, oh, we're going to go back to the moon. That's going to be the next big thing. Or maybe land on an asteroid. Where does that get you? That does not get millions of people into outer space to preserve our birthright to the stars. And also, they want to take their wars there. The first thing into outer space is the military. Well, that's a long story. That's what the Diamond Principle, one of the points in the Diamond Principle, my latest book that was released in August of, not this past August, but about a year and a half ago. The whole point is that people simply don't understand science. Science can set you free, but it also would teach you how to live easily in the universe, how to travel easily. The electromagnetic propulsion systems, the electric highways to the stars. Those are titles and words, phrases I've coined in the past. But living in the universe is very simple. That comes back to living on Earth. Everybody's running around working a 40-hour job, and that seems to be, but everybody's worried about not having a job. Well, society is set up so that you're entrapped. You're doing nothing but running around working a job, trying to make as much money as you can to just pay your house payment, which is basically 100% interest. You're not buying a house, you're paying some banker phony money for interest. So the society as we know it is collapsing. There's no two ways about it, but this, remember, is a planned event. It's a way to take people down and basically enslave them. But you can't do any of this without phony bad science. So the Big Bang, Dirty Snowball Comet Model, the stagnant nature of the solar system, that nothing has happened and nothing changes over billions of years. These are all concepts that are needed to enslave the public. That's the garbage science in every glossy magazine, every TV show, the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, National Geographic specials, National Geographic magazine, Discover magazine, Sky and Telescope, Astronomy magazine, all of these for the public all pound these same messages, none of which could possibly be true. The history of man is very rich. The history of the world is very rich. And there have been many events, celestial events, that have shaped our history. These are totally denied by standard science, and therefore they're totally denied by every other teaching center on Earth, including the churches. As I said, the churches don't really recognize something happened to Moses or Noah. They teach it as if it were fairy tales. So the end result is that the public needs to wake up, but I don't see that happening. What really has to happen is people on an individual basis are going to have to understand this and start studying the topic. It's a very complex topic. You have a tremendous amount of misinformation coming at you. It just, on all sides, for the average person to sort this out is almost impossible. Okay, I've got a few minutes left here. I just this is probably one of the last times that before the holidays that you have time to order and get items sent to you or sent to someone else. Just want to remind you that any of the items on my webpage are you can ship to basically any place in the world. They've gone every place, just about, and any foreign country or any place in the United States. So it's a good way to send a gift to somebody. The Dalton water filters, there's the three sizes, the stainless steel water filter, the high capacity plastic water filter, and then the mini travel water filter. It's a great gift for, I think, $69.95 on the webpage. And then all my books and CDs, etc. So, okay, I'm not going to waste any more time on the show talking about that. But just remember, go to the webpage, JMCC, S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, JMCCSCI.com, 7 letters. And also make sure you visit the, for example, the radio archives. There's over 4 gigabytes now. I think it's almost 4.5 gigabytes of information on my webpage. So that's something that you can spend a lot of time on. And some people say, as far as the radio archives, well, they'd like a list of topics for that particular show. And I don't list topics like that, because I want people to listen to the entire show. I don't want people just going in and listening to sound bites and thinking they're coming away with my message. No, that's not the way it works. You have to spend serious time and serious effort. And once your brain clicks over that threshold where nothing quite made sense before, nothing in the news really made sense, once you start realizing what's going on this planet, then all of these things start to fall in line and you, in fact, are going to start understanding the world in a whole different light. And science is at the very core of this. So, once again, the webpage, jmccsci.com. In the upcoming weeks, I'll be talking more about solar conditions as we move into as the solar cycle increases in power. So that'll be a constant. Also, I'm trying to make these lectures as down-to-earth and meaningful as possible, but there again, this is information you're not going to find any place else on the planet, on the web, any place else. This is the only place you're going to find this information. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.